friends operate mainly on the model of communal sharing. They freely share food at a dinner party, and they do each other favors without keeping score. But they may also recognize special circumstances that call for some other relational model. They may work together on a task in which one is an expert and gives orders to the other. Authority ranking, split the cost of gas on a trip, equality matching, or transact the sale of a car at its blue book value, market pricing. Infractions of a relational model are moralized as straightforwardly wrong. Within the communal sharing model that usually governs a friendship, it is wrong for one person to stint on sharing. Within the special case of equality matching of gas on a trip, an infraction consists of failing to pay for one's share. Equality matching, with its assumption of a continuing reciprocal relationship, allows for loose accounting, as when the ranchers of Shasta County compensated each other for damage with roughly equivalent favors, and agreed to lump it when a small act of damage went uncompensated. Market pricing and other rational legal models are less forgiving. A diner who leaves an expensive restaurant without paying cannot count on the owner to let him make it up in the long run, or simply to lump it. The owner is more likely to call the police. When a person violates the terms of a relational model he or she has tacitly agreed to, the violator is seen as a parasite or cheater and becomes a target of moralistic anger. But when a person applies one relational model to a resource ordinarily governed by another, a different psychology comes into play. That person doesn't violate the rules so much as he or she doesn't get them. The reaction can range from puzzlement, embarrassment, and awkwardness to shock, offense, and rage. Imagine, for example, a diner thanking a restaurateur for an enjoyable experience and offering to have him over for dinner at some point in the future, treating a market pricing interaction as if it were governed by communal sharing. Conversely, imagine the reaction at a dinner party, communal sharing, if a guest pulled out his wallet and offered to pay the host for the meal, market pricing, or if the host asked a guest to wash the pots while the host relaxed in front of the television, equality matching. Likewise, imagine that the guest offered to sell his car to the host and then drove a hard bargain on the price, or the host suggested that the couples swap partners for a half hour of sex before everyone went home for the evening. The emotional response to a relational mismatch depends on whether it is accidental or deliberate, which model is substituted for which, and the nature of the resource. The psychologist Philip Tetlock has suggested that the psychology of taboo, a reaction of outrage to certain thoughts being aired, comes into play with resources that are deemed sacred. A sacred value is one that may not be traded off against anything else. Sacred resources are usually governed by the primal models of communality and authority, and they trigger the taboo reaction when someone treats them with the more advanced models of equality matching or market pricing. If someone offered to purchase your child, suddenly thrusting a communal sharing relationship under the light of market pricing, you would not ask how much he was offering, but would be offended at the very idea. The same is true for an offer to buy a personal gift or family heirloom that has been bestowed upon you, or to pay you for betraying a friend, a spouse, or your country. Tetlock found that when the students were asked their opinion on the pros and cons of an open market for sacred resources like votes, military service, jury duty, body organs, or babies put up for adoption, most of them did not articulate a good case against the practice, such as that the poor might sell their organs out of desperation, but expressed outrage at being asked. Typical arguments were, "This is degrading, dehumanizing, and unacceptable," and, "What kind of people are we becoming?" The psychology of taboo is not completely irrational. To maintain precious relationships, it is not enough for us to say and do the right thing. We also have to show that our heart is in the right place, that we don't weigh the costs and benefits of selling out those who trust us. When you are faced with an indecent proposal, anything less than an indignant refusal would betray the awful truth that you don't understand what it means to be a genuine parent or spouse or citizen. And that understanding consists of having absorbed a cultural norm that assigns a sacred value to a primal relational model. In an old joke, a man asks a woman if she would sleep with him for $1 million, and she says she would consider it. He then asks if she would sleep with him for $100, and she replies, "What kind of a woman do you think I am?" He answers, "We've already established that. We're just haggling over the price." To understand the joke is to appreciate that most sacred values are in fact pseudo-sacred. People can be induced to compromise on them if the trade-off is obfuscated, spin-doctored, or reframed. The joke uses the landmark figure, $1 million, because it reframes a mere exchange of money into a life-transforming opportunity, namely becoming a millionaire. When life insurance was first introduced, people were outraged at the very idea of assigning a dollar value to a human life and of allowing wives to bet that their husbands would die, both of which are technically accurate descriptions of what life insurance does. The insurance industry mounted advertising campaigns that reframed the product as an act of responsibility and decency on the part of the husband, who would simply be carrying out his duty to his family during a period in which he happened not to be alive. Tetlock distinguishes three kinds of trade-offs. Routine trade-offs are those that fall within a single relational model, such as choosing to be with one friend rather than another, or to purchase one car rather than another. Taboo trade-offs pit a sacred value in one model against a secular value in another, such as selling out a friend, a loved one, an organ, or oneself for barter or cash. Tragic trade-offs pit sacred values against each other, as in deciding which of two needy transplant patients should receive an organ, or the ultimate tragic trade-off, Sophie's choice between the lives of her two children. The art of politics, Tetlock points out, is in large part the ability to reframe taboo trade-offs as tragic trade-offs, or, when one is in the opposition, to do the opposite. A politician who wants to reform Social Security has to reframe it from breaking our faith with senior citizens, his opponent's framing, to lifting the burden on hard-working wage earners, or no longer scrimping in the education of our children. Keeping troops in Afghanistan is reframed from putting the lives of our soldiers in danger to guaranteeing our nation's commitment to freedom, or winning the war on terror. The reframing of sacred values, as we will see, may be an overlooked tactic in the psychology of peacemaking. The new theories of the moral sense, then, have helped explain moralized emotions, moral compartmentalization, and taboo. Now let's apply them to differences in moralization across cultures and, crucially, over the course of history. Many assignments of a relational model to a set of social roles feel natural to people in all societies and may be rooted in our biology. They include the communal sharing among family members, an authority ranking within the family that makes people respect their elders, and the exchange of bulk commodities and routine favors under equality matching. But other kinds of assignment of a relational model to a resource and a set of social roles can differ radically across time and culture. In traditional Western marriages, for example, the husband wielded authority over the wife. The model was mostly overturned in the 1970s, and some couples influenced by feminism switched to equality matching, splitting housework and child-rearing down the middle and strictly auditing the hours devoted to them. Since the business-like psychology of equality matching clashes with the intimacy that most couples crave, most modern marriages have settled on communal sharing, with the consequence that many wives feel that the couple's failure to keep tabs on contributions to household duties leaves them overworked and underappreciated. The spouses may also carve out rational legal exceptions, such as a prenuptial agreement or the stipulation in their wills of separate inheritances for the children of their previous marriages. Alternative linkages between a relational model and a resource or set of social roles define how cultures differ from one another. The members of one society may allow land to be bartered or sold and be shocked to learn of another society that does the same with brides or vice versa. In one culture, a woman's sexuality may fall under the authority of the males in her family. In another, she is free to share it with her lover in a communal relationship. In still another, she may barter it for an equivalent favor without stigma, an example of equality matching. In some societies, a killing must be avenged by the victim's kinsman, equality matching. In others, it may be compensated with a Wehrgeld, market pricing. In still others, it is punished by the state, authority ranking. A recognition that someone belongs to a different culture can mitigate, to some extent, the outrage ordinarily triggered by the violation of a relational model. Such violations can even be a source of humor, as in old comedies in which a hapless immigrant or rural bumpkin haggles over the price of a train ticket, grazes his sheep in a public park, or offers to settle a debt by betrothing his daughter in marriage. The formula is reversed in Borat, in which the comedian Sacha Baron Cohen pokes fun at the willingness of culturally sensitive Americans to tolerate the outrageous behavior of an obnoxious immigrant in their midst. Tolerance may run out, however, when a violation breaches a sacred value, as when immigrants to Western countries practice female genital cutting, honor killings, or the sale of underage brides, and when Westerners disrespect the Prophet Muhammad by depicting him in novels, satirizing him in editorial cartoons, or allowing schoolchildren to name a teddy bear after him. Differences in the deployment of relational models also define political ideologies. Fascism, feudalism, theocracy, and other atavistic ideologies are based on the primal relational models of communal sharing and authority ranking. The interests of an individual are submerged within a community. Fascist comes from an Italian word for bundle, and the community is dominated by a military, aristocratic, or ecclesiastical hierarchy. Communism envisioned a communal sharing of resources, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need, an equality matching of the means of production, and an authority ranking of political control, in theory the dictatorship of the proletariat, in practice a nomenclatura of commissars under a charismatic dictator. A kind of populist socialism seeks equality matching for life's necessities, such as land, medicine, education, and child care. At the other pole of the continuum, libertarians would allow people to negotiate virtually any resource under market pricing, including organs, babies, medical care, sexuality, and education. Tucked in between these poles is the familiar liberal-conservative continuum. In several surveys, Haidt has shown that liberals believe that morality is a matter of preventing harm and enforcing fairness, the values that line up with Schroeder's autonomy and Fisk's equality matching. Conservatives give equal weight to all five foundations, including in-group loyalty, values such as stability, tradition, and patriotism, purity/sanctity, values such as propriety, decency, and religious observance, and authority/respect. Values such as respect for authority, deference to God, acknowledgement of gender roles, and military obedience. The American culture war, with its clashes over taxes, medical insurance, welfare, gay marriage, abortion, the size of the military, the teaching of evolution, profanity in the media, and the separation of church and state, is fought in large part over different conceptions of the legitimate moral concerns of the state. Haidt notes that the ideologues at each pole are apt to view their opposite number as amoral, whereas in fact the moral circuitry in all of their brains is burning just as brightly, while filled with different conceptions of what morality comprises. Before spelling out the connections between moral psychology and violence, let me use the theory of relational models to resolve a psychological puzzle that has been left hanging from earlier chapters. Many moral advances have taken the form of a shift in sensibilities that made an action seem more ridiculous than sinful, such as dueling, bullfighting, and jingoistic war. And many effective social critics, such as Swift, Johnson, Voltaire, Twain, Oscar Wilde, Bertrand Russell, Tom Lehrer, and George Carlin, have been smart-ass comedians rather than thundering prophets. What in our psychology allows the joke to be mightier than the sword? Humor works by confronting an audience with an incongruity which may be resolved by switching to another frame of reference. And in that alternative frame of reference, the butt of the joke occupies a lowly or undignified status. When Woody Allen says, "I'm very proud of my gold watch. My grandfather sold it to me on his deathbed," listeners are at first surprised that an emotionally precious heirloom would be sold rather than given, particularly by someone who cannot profit from the sale. Then they realize that the Woody Allen character is unloved and comes from a family of venal oddballs. Often the first reference frame, which sets up the incongruity, consists of a prevailing relational model, and to get the joke, the audience must step outside it, as in the switch from communal sharing to market pricing in the Woody Allen joke. Humor with a political or moral agenda can stealthily challenge a relational model that is second nature to an audience by forcing them to see that it leads to consequences that the rest of their minds recognize as absurd. Rufus T. Firefly's willingness to declare war in response to a wholly imagined insult in Duck Soup deconstructs the authority-ranking ethos of national grandeur and was appreciated in an era in which the image of war was shifting from thrilling and glorious to wasteful and stupid. Satire also served as an accelerant to recent social changes, such as the 1960s portrayals of racists and sexists as thick-witted Neanderthals and of Vietnam hawks as bloodthirsty psychopaths. The Soviet Union and its satellites also harbored a deep underground current of satire, as in the common definition of the two Cold War ideologies, capitalism is the exploitation of man by man. Communism is the exact opposite. According to the 18th century writer Mary Wortley Montagu, satire should, like a polished razor keen, wound with a touch that's scarcely felt or seen. But satire is seldom polished that keenly, and the butts of a joke may be all too aware of the subversive power of humor. They may react with a rage that is stoked by the intentional insult to a sacred value, the deflation of their dignity, and a realization that laughter indicates a common knowledge of both. The lethal riots in 2005, provoked by the editorial cartoons in the Danish newspaper Jyllandsposten, for example, one showing Muhammad in heaven greeting newly arrived suicide bombers with, "Stop, we have run out of virgins," show that when it comes to the deliberate undermining of a sacred relational model, humor is no laughing matter. How do the relational models that make up the moral sense license the various kinds of violence that people feel are morally legitimate? And what degree of freedom allows societies to throttle down moralistic violence, or, better still, shift it into reverse? All the relational models invite moralistic punishment of the people who violate their rules of engagement, but each model licenses a distinctive kind of violence as well. Human beings, Fisk notes, need not relate to one another using any of the models at all, a state he calls a null or asocial relationship. People who don't fall under a relational model are dehumanized. They are seen as lacking the essential features of human nature and are treated, in effect, like inanimate objects which may be ignored, exploited, or preyed upon at will. An asocial relationship thus sets the stage for the predatory violence of conquest, rape, assassination, infanticide, strategic bombing, colonial expulsions, and other crimes of convenience. Placing other people under the aegis of a relational model imposes at least some obligation to take their interests into account. Communal sharing has sympathy and warmth built into it, but only for members of the in-group. Fisk's collaborator, Nick Haslam, argued that communal sharing can lead to a second kind of dehumanization, not the mechanistic dehumanization of an asocial relationship, but an animalistic dehumanization that denies to outsiders the traits that are commonly perceived as uniquely human, such as reason, individuality, self-control, morality, and culture. Rather than being treated with callousness or indifference, such outsiders are treated with disgust or contempt. Communal sharing may encourage this dehumanization because the excluded people are seen as lacking the pure and sacred essence that unites the members of the tribe, and thereby they threaten to pollute it with their animal contaminants. So communal sharing, for all its cuddly connotations, supports the mindset behind genocidal ideologies based on tribe, race, ethnicity, and religion. Authority ranking also has two sides. It brings a paternalistic responsibility to protect and support one's underlings, and thus may be the psychological basis of the pacification process, in which overlords protect their subject peoples from internecine violence. In a similar way, it furnishes the moral rationalizations employed by slaveholders, colonial overlords, and benevolent despots. But authority ranking also justifies violent punishment for insolence, insubordination, disobedience, treason, blasphemy, heresy, and lèse majesté. When welded to communal sharing, it justifies group-over-group violence, including imperial and jingoistic conquest and the subjugation of subordinate castes, colonies, and slaves. More benevolent is the obligation of reciprocal exchange in equality matching, which gives each party a stake in the continued existence and well-being of the other. Equality matching also encourages a modicum of perspective-taking, which, as we have seen, can turn into genuine sympathy. The pacifying effect of commerce between individuals and nations may depend on a mindset in which exchange partners, even if they are not genuinely loved, are at least valued. On the other hand, equality matching supplies the rationale for tit-for-tat retaliation, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life, blood for blood. As we saw in Chapter 8, even people in modern societies are apt to conceive of criminal punishment as just deserts, rather than as general or specific deterrence. Rational legal reasoning, the add-on to the moral repertoire in literate and numerate societies, does not come with its own intuitions or emotions, and by itself neither encourages nor discourages violence. Unless all people are explicitly enfranchised and granted ownership of their own bodies and property, the amoral pursuit of profit in a market economy can exploit them in slave markets, human trafficking, and the opening of foreign markets with gunboats. And the deployment of quantitative tools can be used to maximize kill ratios in the waging of high-tech war. Yet rational legal reasoning, as we shall see, can also be put in the service of a utilitarian morality that calculates the greatest good for the greatest number, and that titrates the amount of legitimate police and military force to the minimum necessary to reduce the aggregate amount of violence. What, then, are the historical changes in moral psychology that encouraged reductions in violence, such as the Humanitarian Revolution, the Long Peace, and the Rights Revolutions? The direction of the change in prevailing models is clear enough. Over the last three centuries throughout the world, Fisk and Tetlock observe, there has been a rapidly accelerating tendency of social systems as a whole to move from communal sharing to authority ranking to equality matching to market pricing. And if we use the polling data from Chapter 7 as an indication that social liberals are at the leading edge of changes in attitudes that eventually drag along social conservatives as well, then Haidt's data on the moral concerns of liberals and conservatives tell the same story. In judging the importance of moral concerns, recall, social liberals place little weight on in-group loyalty and purity/sanctity, which Fisk lumps under communal sharing, and they place little weight on authority/respect. Instead, they invest all their moral concern in harm/care and fairness/reciprocity. Social conservatives spread their moral portfolio over all five. The trend toward social liberalism, then, is a trend away from communal and authoritarian values and toward values based on equality, fairness, autonomy, and legally enforced rights. Though both liberals and conservatives may deny that any such a trend has taken place, consider the fact that no mainstream conservative politician today would invoke tradition, authority, cohesion, or religion to justify racial segregation, keeping women out of the workforce, or criminalizing homosexuality, arguments they made just a few decades ago. Why might a disinvestment of moral resources from community, sanctity, and authority militate against violence? One reason is that communality can legitimize tribalism and jingoism, and authority can legitimize government repression. But a more general reason is that a retrenchment of the moral sense to smaller territories leaves fewer transgressions for which people may legitimately be punished. There is a bedrock of morality based on autonomy and fairness on which everyone, traditional and modern, liberal and conservative, agrees. No one objects to the use of government violence to put assailants, rapists, and murderers behind bars, but defenders of traditional morality wish to heap many nonviolent infractions on top of this consensual layer, such as homosexuality, licentiousness, blasphemy, heresy, indecency, and desecration of sacred symbols. For their moral disapproval to have teeth, traditionalists must get the Leviathan to punish those offenders as well. Expunging these offenses from the law books gives the authorities fewer grounds for clubbing, cuffing, paddling, jailing, or executing people. The momentum of social norms in the direction of market pricing gives many people the willies, but it would, for better or worse, extrapolate the trend toward nonviolence. Radical libertarians who love the market pricing model would decriminalize prostitution, drug possession, and gambling, and thereby empty the world's prisons of millions of people currently kept there by force, to say nothing of sending pimps and drug lords the way of prohibition gangsters. The progression toward personal freedom raises the question of whether it is morally desirable to trade a measure of socially sanctioned violence for a measure of behavior that many people deem intrinsically wrong, such as blasphemy, homosexuality, drug use, and prostitution. But that's just the point. Right or wrong, retracting the moral sense from its traditional spheres of community, authority, and purity entails a reduction of violence. And that retraction is precisely the agenda of classical liberalism. A freedom of individuals from tribal and authoritarian force, and a tolerance of personal choices as long as they do not infringe on the autonomy and well-being of others. The historical direction of morality in modern societies is not just away from communality and authority, but toward rational legal organization. And that, too, is a pacifying development. Fiske notes that utilitarian morality, with its goal of securing the greatest good for the greatest number, is a paradigm case of the market pricing model, itself a special case of the rational legal mindset. Recall that it was the utilitarianism of Cesare Beccaria that led to a re-engineering of criminal punishment away from a raw hunger for retribution and toward a calibrated policy of deterrence. Jeremy Bentham used utilitarian reasoning to undermine the rationalizations for punishing homosexuals and mistreating animals, and John Stuart Mill used it to make an early case for feminism. The national reconciliation movements of the 1990s, in which Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, and other peacemakers abjured in-kind retributive justice for a cocktail of truth-telling, amnesty, and measured punishment of the most atrocious perpetrators, was another accomplishment of violence reduction via calculated proportionality. So is the policy of responding to international provocations with economic sanctions and tactics of containment rather than retaliatory strikes. If the recent theories of moral psychology are on the right track, then intuitions of community, authority, sacredness, and taboo are part of human nature and will probably always be with us, even if we try to sequester their influence. This is not necessarily a cause for alarm. Relational models can be combined and embedded, and rational legal reasoning that seeks to minimize overall violence can strategically deploy the other mental models in benign ways. If a version of communal sharing is assigned to the resource of human life and applied to a community consisting of the entire species rather than a family, tribe, or nation, it can serve as an emotional undergirding of the abstract principle of human rights. We are all one big family, and no one within it may usurp the life or freedom of anyone else. Authority ranking may authorize the state's monopoly on the use of violence in order to prevent greater violence, and the authority of the state over its citizens can be embedded in other authority rankings in the form of democratic checks and balances, as when the president can veto the bills of Congress, while at the same time Congress can impeach and remove the president. Sacred values, and the taboos that protect them, can be attached to resources that we decide are genuinely precious, such as identifiable lives, national borders, and the non-use of chemical and nuclear weapons. An ingenious rerouting of the psychology of taboo in the service of peace has recently been explored by Scott Atran, working with the psychologists Jeremy Gingis and Douglas Meaden, and the political scientist Khalil Shikaki. In theory, peace negotiations should take place within a framework of market pricing. A surplus is generated when adversaries lay down their arms, the so-called peace dividend, and the two sides get to yes by agreeing to divide it. Each side compromises on its maximalist demand in order to enjoy a portion of that surplus, which is greater than what they would end up with if they walked away from the table and had to pay the price of continuing conflict. Unfortunately, the mindset of sacredness and taboo can confound the best-laid plans of rational dealmakers. If a value is sacred in the minds of one of the antagonists, then it has infinite value and may not be traded away for any other good, just as one may not sell one's child for any other good. People inflamed by nationalist and religious fervor hold certain values sacred, such as sovereignty over hallowed ground, or an acknowledgement of ancient atrocities. To compromise them for the sake of peace or prosperity is taboo. The very thought unmasks the thinker as a traitor, a quisling, a mercenary, a whore. In a daring experiment, the researchers did not simply avail themselves of the usual convenience sample of a few dozen undergraduates who fill out questionnaires for beer money. They surveyed real players in the Israeli-Palestine dispute, more than 600 Jewish settlers in the West Bank, more than 500 Palestinian refugees, and more than 700 Palestinian students, half of whom identified with Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad. The team had no trouble finding fanatics within each group who treated their demands as sacred values. Almost half the Israeli settlers indicated that it would never be permissible for the Jewish people to give up part of the land of Israel, including Judea and Samaria, which make up the West Bank, no matter how great the benefit. Among the Palestinians, more than half the students indicated that it was impermissible to compromise on sovereignty over Jerusalem, no matter how great the benefit. And 80% of the refugees held that no compromise was possible on the right of return of Palestinians to Israel. The researchers divided each group into thirds and presented them with a hypothetical peace deal that required all sides to compromise on a sacred value. The deal was a two-state solution in which the Israelis would withdraw from 99% of the West Bank and Gaza, but would not have to absorb Palestinian refugees. Not surprisingly, the proposal did not go over well. The absolutists on both sides reacted with anger and disgust and said that they would, if necessary, resort to violence to oppose the deal. With a third of the participants, the deals were sweetened with cash compensation from the United States and the European Union, such as $1 billion a year for 100 years, or a guarantee that the people would live in peace and prosperity. With these sweeteners on the table, the non-absolutists, as expected, softened their opposition a bit. But the absolutists, forced to contemplate a taboo trade-off, were even more disgusted, angry, and prepared to resort to violence. So much for the rational actor conception of human behavior when it comes to politico-religious conflict. All this would be pretty depressing were it not for Tetlock's observation that many ostensibly sacred values are really pseudo-sacred and may be compromised if a taboo trade-off is cleverly reframed. In a third variation of the hypothetical peace deal, the two-state solution was augmented with a purely symbolic declaration by the enemy in which it compromised one of its sacred values. In the deal presented to the Israeli settlers, the Palestinians would give up any claims to their right of return, which is sacred to them, or would be required to recognize the historic and legitimate right of the Jewish people to Eretz Israel. In the deal presented to the Palestinians, Israel would recognize the historic and legitimate right of the Palestinians to their own state and would apologize for all of the wrongs done to the Palestinian people, or would give up what they believe is their sacred right to the West Bank, or would symbolically recognize the historic legitimacy of the right of return. while not actually granting it. The verbiage made a difference. Unlike the bribes of money or peace, the symbolic concession of a sacred value by the enemy, especially when it acknowledges a sacred value on one's own side, reduced the absolutist's anger, disgust, and willingness to endorse violence. The reductions did not shrink the absolutists' numbers to a minority of their respective sides, but the proportions were large enough to have potentially reversed the outcomes of their recent national elections. The implications of this manipulation of people's moral psychology are profound. To find anything that softens the opposition of Israeli and Palestinian fanatics to what the rest of the world recognizes as the only viable solution to their conflict is something close to a miracle. The standard tools of diplomacy wonks who treat the disputants as rational actors and try to manipulate the costs and benefits of a peace agreement can backfire. Instead, they must treat the disputants as moralistic actors and manipulate the symbolic framing of the peace agreement if they want a bit of daylight to open up. The human moral sense is not always an obstacle to peace, but it can be when the mindset of sacredness and taboo is allowed free rein. Only when that mindset is redeployed under the direction of rational goals will it yield an outcome that can truly be called moral. What exogenous causes are shifting the allocation of moral intuitions away from community, authority, and purity, and toward fairness, autonomy, and rationality? One obvious force is geographic and social mobility. People are no longer confined to the small worlds of family, village, and tribe, in which conformity and solidarity are essential to daily life, and ostracism and exile are a form of social death. They can seek their fortunes in other circles, which expose them to alternative worldviews and lead them into a more ecumenical morality, which gravitates to the rights of individuals rather than chauvinistic veneration of the group. By the same token, open societies where talent, ambition, or luck can dislodge people from the station in which they were born are less likely to see an authority ranking as an inviolable law of nature and more likely to see it as a historical artifact or a legacy of injustice. When diverse individuals mingle, engage in commerce, and find themselves on professional or social teams that cooperate to attain a superordinate goal, their intuitions of purity can be diluted. One example, mentioned in Chapter 7, is the greater tolerance of homosexuality among people who personally know homosexuals. Haight observes that when one zooms in on an electoral map of the United States from the coarse division into red and blue states to a finer-grained division into red and blue counties, one finds that the blue counties, representing the regions that voted for the more liberal presidential candidate, cluster along the coasts and major waterways. Before the advent of jet airplanes and interstate highways, these were the places where people and their ideas most easily mixed. That early advantage installed them as hubs of transportation, commerce, media, research, and education, and they continue to be pluralistic and liberal zones today. Though American political liberalism is by no means the same as classical liberalism, the two overlap in their weighting of the moral spheres. The microgeography of liberalism suggests that the moral trend away from community authority and purity is indeed an effect of mobility and cosmopolitanism. Another subverter of community, authority, and purity is the objective study of history. The mindset of communality, Fiske notes, conceives of the group as eternal. The group is held together by an immutable essence, and its traditions stretch back to the dawn of time. Authority rankings, too, are naturally portrayed as everlasting. They were ordained by the gods, or are inherent in a great chain of being that organizes the universe. And both models boast an abiding nobility and purity as part of their essential nature. In this tissue of rationalizations, a real historian is about as welcome as a skunk at a garden party. Donald Brown, before he embarked on his survey of human universals, wanted to explain why the Hindus of India had produced so little in the way of serious historical scholarship, unlike the neighboring civilizations of China. The elites of a hereditary caste society, he suspected, figured that no good could come from scholars nosing around in archives where they might stumble upon evidence that undermined their claims to have descended from heroes and gods. Brown looked at 25 civilizations in Asia and Europe and found that the ones that were stratified into hereditary classes favored myth, legend, and hagiography, and discouraged history, social science, natural science, biography, realistic portraiture, and uniform education. More recently, the nationalist movements of the 19th and 20th centuries recruited cadres of hacks to write potted histories of their nation's timeless values and glorious pasts. Beginning in the 1960s, many democracies were traumatized by revisionist histories that unearthed their nation's shallow roots and exposed their sordid misdeeds. The declines of patriotism, tribalism, and trust in hierarchies are in part a legacy of the new historiography. Many liberal conservative battles continue to be fought over school curricula and museum exhibits. Though historical fact is the best antidote to self-serving legend, the imaginative projections of fiction can also reorient an audience's moral sense. The protagonists of many plots have struggled with conflicts between a morality defined by loyalty, obedience, patriotism, duty, law, or convention, and the course of action that is morally defensible. In the 1967 film Cool Hand Luke, a prison guard is about to punish Paul Newman by locking him in a sweltering box and explains, "Sorry, Luke, I'm just doing my job. You gotta appreciate that." Luke replies, "Nah. Calling it your job don't make it right, boss." Less often, an author can shake readers into realizing that conscience itself can be an untrustworthy guide to what is right. Huckleberry Finn, while drifting down the Mississippi, is suddenly racked with guilt over having helped Jim escape from his lawful owner and reach a free state. "Jim talked out loud all the time while I was talking to myself. He was saying how the first thing he would do when he got to a free state, he would go to saving up money and never spend a single cent, and when he got enough, he would buy his wife, which was owned on a farm close to where Miss Watson lived, and then they would both work to buy the two children, and if their master wouldn't sell them, they'd get an abolitionist to go and steal them." It most froze me to hear such talk. Thinks I, this is what comes of my not thinking. Here was this nigger, which I had as good as helped to run away, coming right out flat-footed and saying he would steal his children, children that belonged to a man I didn't even know, a man that hadn't ever done me no harm. My conscience got to stirring me up hotter than ever, until at last I says to it, "Let up on me. It ain't too late yet. I'll paddle ashore at the first light and tell." All my troubles was gone. I went to looking out sharp for a light and sort of singing to myself. By and by one showed. Jim jumped and got the canoe ready and put his old coat in the bottom for me to set on and give me the paddle, and as I shoved off, he says, "Pooty soon I'll be a-shoutin' for joy, and I'll say, it's all on accounts of Huck. I's a free man, and I couldn't ever been free if it hadn't been for Huck. Huck done it. Jim won't ever forget you, Huck. You's de best friend Jim's ever had, and you's de only friend old Jim's got now." I was paddling off all in a sweat to tell on him, but when he says this, it seemed to kind of take the tuck all out of me. In this heart-stopping sequence, a conscience guided by principle, obedience, reciprocity, and sympathy for a stranger pulls Huck in the wrong direction, and an immediate tug on his sympathy from a friend, bolstered in the reader's mind by a conception of human rights, pulls him in the right one. It is perhaps the finest portrayal of the vulnerability of the human moral sense to competing convictions, most of which are morally wrong. Reason. Reason appears to have fallen on hard times. Popular culture is plumbing new depths of dumph, and American political discourse has become a race to the bottom. We are living in an era of scientific creationism, New Age flim-flam, 9/11 conspiracy theories, psychic hotlines, and resurgent religious fundamentalism. As if the proliferation of unreason weren't bad enough, many commentators have been mustering their powers of reason to argue that reason is overrated. During the honeymoon following George W. Bush's inauguration in 2001, editorialists opined that a great president need not be intelligent because a good heart and steadfast moral clarity are superior to the triangulations and equivocations of overeducated mandarins. After all, they said, it was the Harvard-educated best and brightest who dragged America into the quagmire of Vietnam. Critical theorists and postmodernists on the left and defenders of religion on the right agree on one thing, that the two world wars and the Holocaust were the poisoned fruit of the West's cultivation of science and reason since the Enlightenment. Even the scientists are piling on. Human beings are led by their passions, say many psychologists, and deploy their puny powers of reason only to rationalize their gut feelings after the fact. Behavioral economists exult in showing how human behavior departs from the rational actor theory, and the journalists who publicize their work waste no opportunity to smack the theory around. The implication is that since irrationality is inevitable, we may as well lie back and enjoy it. In this section, the last before the concluding chapter, I will try to convince you that both the pessimistic assessment of the state of reason in the world and any sentiment that this would not be such a bad thing are mistaken. For all their foolishness, modern societies have been getting smarter, and all things being equal, a smarter world is a less violent world. Before we turn to this evidence, let me sweep away some of the prejudices against reason. Now that the presidency of George W. Bush is over, the theory that we are better off with unintellectual leaders is just embarrassing, and the reasons for the embarrassment may be quantified. Measuring the psychological traits of public figures, to be sure, has a sketchy history, but the psychologist Dean Simonton has developed several historiometric measures that are reliable and valid in the psychometrician's technical sense and politically nonpartisan. He analyzed a data set of 42 presidents from GW to GWB and found that both raw intelligence and openness to new ideas and values are significantly correlated with presidential performance, as it has been assessed by nonpartisan historians. Though Bush himself is well above the average of the population in intelligence, he is the third lowest among the presidents and comes in dead last in openness to experience, with a rock-bottom score of 0.0 on the 0 to 100 scale. Simonton published his work in 2006 while Bush was still in office, but the three historians' surveys conducted since then bear out the correlation. Bush was ranked 37th, 36th, and 39th among the 42 presidents. As for Vietnam, the implication that the United States would have avoided the war if only the advisors of Kennedy and Johnson had been less intelligent seems unlikely in light of the fact that, after they left the scene, the war was ferociously prosecuted by Richard Nixon, who was neither the best nor the brightest. The relationship between presidential intelligence and war may also be quantified. Between 1946, when the Prio dataset begins, and 2008, a president's IQ is negatively correlated with the number of battle deaths in wars involving the United States during his presidency, with a coefficient of minus 0.45. One could say that for every presidential IQ point, 13,440 fewer people die in battle, though it's more accurate to say that the three smartest post-war presidents, Kennedy, Carter, and Clinton, kept the country out of destructive wars. The idea that the Holocaust was a product of the Enlightenment is ludicrous, if not obscene. As we saw in Chapter 6, what changed in the 20th century was not so much the occurrence of genocide as the recognition that genocide was something bad. The technological and bureaucratic trappings of the Holocaust are a sideshow in the reckoning of its human costs and are unnecessary to the perpetration of mass murder, as the bloody machetes of the Rwandan genocide remind us. Nazi ideology, like the nationalist, romantic militarist, and communist movements of the same era, was a fruit of the 19th century counter-enlightenment, not the line of thinking that connects Erasmus, Bacon, Hobbes, Spinoza, Locke, Hume, Kant, Bentham, Jefferson, Madison, and Mill. The scientific pretensions of Nazism were risible pseudoscience, as real science easily showed. In a brilliant recent essay, the philosopher Yaki Menschenfreund reviews the theory that Enlightenment rationality is responsible for the Holocaust. It is impossible to understand so destructive a policy without recognizing that Nazi ideology was, for the most part, not only irrational, but anti-rational. It cherished the pagan, pre-Christian past of the German nation, adopted romantic ideas of a return to nature and a more organic existence, and nurtured an apocalyptic expectation of an end of days, whence the eternal struggle between the races would be resolved. The contempt for rationalism and its association with the despised Enlightenment stood at the core of Nazi thought. The movement's ideologues emphasized the contradiction between Weltanschauung, worldview, the natural and direct experience of the world, and Weltandenken, thinking about the world, the destructive intellectual activity that breaks reality down through conceptualization, calculation, and theorization. Against the degenerate liberal bourgeois worship of reason, the Nazis championed the idea of a vital, spontaneous life, unhindered and undimmed by compromises or dilemmas. Finally, let's consider the suggestion that reason is incapable of contending against the brawn of the emotions, a tail that tries to wag the dog. The psychologists David Pizarro and Paul Bloom have argued that this is an overinterpretation of the laboratory phenomena of moral dumbfounding and other visceral reactions to moral dilemmas. Even if a decision is guided by intuition, the intuition itself may be a legacy of moral reasoning that had taken place beforehand, whether in private reflection, in dinner table debates, or through the assimilation of norms that were the output of past debates. Case studies reveal that at critical moments in an individual's life, such as a woman's decision to have an abortion, or at critical moments in a society's history, such as the struggles over civil, women's, and gay rights and the nation's participation in war, people can be consumed in agonizing reflection and deliberation. We have seen many historic moral changes that originated in painstaking intellectual briefs, which were in turn met with furious rebuttals. Once the debate had been settled, the winning side entrenched itself in people's sensibilities and erased its own tracks. Today, for example, people might be dumbfounded when asked whether we should burn heretics, keep slaves, whip children, or break criminals on the wheel. Yet those very debates took place several centuries ago. We even saw a neuroanatomical basis for the give and take between intuition and reasoning in Joshua Green's studies of trolley problems in the brain scanner. Each of these moral faculties has distinct neurobiological hubs. When Hume famously wrote that reason is and ought to be only the slave of the passions, he was not advising people to shoot from the hip, blow their stack, or fall head over heels for Mr. Wrong. He was basically making the logical point that reason, by itself, is just a means of getting from one true proposition to the next, and does not care about the value of those propositions. Nonetheless, there are many reasons why reason, working in conjunction with some particle of the dove kneaded into our frame, must direct the determinations of our mind, and where everything else is equal, produce a cool preference of what is useful and serviceable to mankind, above what is pernicious and dangerous. Let's consider some of the ways the application of reason might be expected to reduce the rate of violence. The chronological sequence in which the scientific revolution and the age of reason preceded the humanitarian revolution reminds us of one big reason, the one captured in Voltaire's quip that absurdities lead to atrocities. A debunking of hogwash, such as the ideas that gods demand sacrifices, witches cast spells, heretics go to hell, Jews poison wells, animals are insensate, children are possessed, Africans are brutish and kings rule by divine right, is bound to undermine many rationales for violence. A second pacifying effect of exercising the faculty of reason is that it goes hand in hand with self-control. Recall that the two traits are statistically correlated in individuals and that their physiological substrates overlap in the brain. It is reason, a deduction of the long-term consequences of an action, that gives the self reasons to control the self. Self-control, moreover, involves more than just avoiding rash choices that will damage one's future self. It can also mean suppressing some of our base instincts in the service of motives that we are better able to justify. Sneaky laboratory techniques, such as measurements of how quickly people associate white and black faces with words like good and bad, and neuroimaging experiments that monitor activity in the amygdala, have shown that many white people have small, visceral, negative reactions to African Americans. Yet the sea change in explicit attitudes toward African Americans and the obvious comedy with which white and blacks live and work with each other today show that people can allow their better judgments to overcome these biases. Reasoning can also interact with the moral sense. Each of the four relational models from which moral impulses spring comes with a particular style of reasoning. Each of these modes of reasoning may be matched with a mathematical scale, and each is implemented by a distinctive family of cognitive intuitions. Communal sharing thinks in all-or-none categories, also called a nominal scale. A person is either in the hallowed group or out of it. The cognitive mindset is that of intuitive biology, with its pure essences and potential contaminants. Authority ranking uses an ordinal scale, the linear ranking of a dominance hierarchy. Its cognitive gadget is an intuitive physics of space, force, and time. Higher-ranking people are deemed bigger, stronger, higher, and first in the series. Equality matching is measured on a scale of intervals, which allows two quantities to be compared to see which is larger, but not entered into proportions. It reckons by concrete procedures, such as lining things up, counting them off, or comparing them with a balance scale. Only market pricing, and the rational legal mindset of which it is a part, allows one to reason in terms of proportionality. The rational legal model requires the non-intuitive tools of symbolic mathematics, such as fractions, percentages, and exponentiation. And as I have mentioned, it is far from universal, and depends on the cogitation-enhancing skills of literacy and numeracy. It's no coincidence that the word proportionality has a moral as well as a mathematical sense. Only preachers and pop singers profess that violence will someday vanish off the face of the earth. A measured degree of violence, even if only held in reserve, will always be necessary in the form of police forces and armies to deter predation or to incapacitate those who cannot be deterred. Yet there is a vast difference between the minimal violence necessary to prevent greater violence and the bolts of fury that an uncalibrated mind is likely to deliver in acts of rough justice. A coarse sense of tit-for-tat payback, especially with the thumb of self-serving biases on the scale, produces many kinds of excess violence, including cruel and unusual punishments, savage beatings of naughty children, destructive retaliatory strikes in war, lethal reprisals for trivial insults, and brutal repression of rebellions by crappy governments in the developing world. By the same token, many moral advances have consisted not of eschewing force across the board, but of applying it in carefully measured doses. Some examples include the reform of criminal punishment following Beccaria's utilitarian arguments, the measured punishments of children by enlightened parents, civil disobedience and passive resistance that stop just short of violence, the calibrated responses to provocations by modern democracies, military exercises, warning shots, surgical strikes on military installations, and the partial amnesties in post-conflict conciliation. These reductions in violence required a sense of proportionality, a habit of mind that does not come naturally and must be cultivated by reason. Reason can also be a force against violence when it abstracts violence itself as a mental category and construes it as a problem to be solved rather than a contest to be won. The Greeks of Homer conceived of their devastating wars as the handiwork of sadistic puppeteers on high. That, to be sure, required a feat of abstraction. They lifted themselves out of a vantage point from which war is the fault of one's eternally treacherous enemies. Yet blaming the gods for war does not open up many practical opportunities for mere mortals to reduce it. Moralistic denunciations of war also single it out as an entity, but they provide few guidelines on what to do when an invading army is at one's doorstep. A real change came in the writings of Grote.